Friday, stocks closed at the highest point in market history with the S&P 500, finishing the week over the 2000 benchmark, while gold and silver recovered from oversold territory. Hi there, everybody. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you with another red-hot episode lined up this weekend. Top interviews from your favorite investment gurus, as well as the financial market headlines affecting your portfolio. So hold on to your iPod earbuds. First out of the bullpen, Louis Navalier says geopolitical unrest is a big positive for the gold market. Plus, corporate earnings momentum is strong. It's as strong as he's ever seen, and conditions will likely persist. He's adding several interesting companies to his portfolio. He likes drone manufacturing and fracking companies. He also expects strong seasonal activity in the stock market well into the Thanksgiving holiday seasons. Plus, he says CEOs and CFOs are buying back record shares of their company's stock, making every equities pullback a potential buying opportunity. You'll want to listen closely for several other stock recommendations. Then we're on to Bob Hoy from Institutional Investors, who thinks the gold bull market is likely to persist well into the next decade. U.S. equities are showing significant signs of a market bubble, plus a second bubble is forming in low-grade bonds. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Mostly sunny weather appeared over the gold market this week. Traders shrugged off dollar strength, turning focus instead to escalating geopolitical concerns in Ukraine. Uncertainty between the West and Russia increased demand for safe haven investments. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added $5.60, finishing at $12.87. Silver added 9 cents, finishing near 1950. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index picked up nearly 3%. Palladium blasted higher by $21, closing at $909, a record high on supply disruption concerns. It was a 13-year high, in fact, amid the Russia-Ukraine drama, which increased the probability of sanctions against Moscow. Russia is still the world's largest palladium producer, accounting for over 40% of global output. Palladium is primarily used to reduce emissions from the exhausts of gasoline engines. And platinum futures added $2.50, finishing at $14.24 an ounce on the NYMEX. West Texas Intermediate crude picked up $2.50 for the week, finishing at $95.84. Well, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko pledged to step up the country's defenses against what he referred to as a de facto incursion after separatists gained ground in the eastern region of Ukraine. Talks of further sanctions against Russia are increasing the safe haven premium for gold. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Friday that Kiev and Western allies were using peace negotiations as a ruse to cover up covert military actions against pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian officials retorted with reports of Russian troops funneling into their nation over the past week. The European Union is slated to discuss the conflict in Ukraine at a summit in Brussels over the weekend. Meanwhile, according to a Commerce Department report, the economy expanded at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.2%, far exceeding estimates. Solid GDP figures are U.S. dollar positive, which flew higher to a new weekly high and sparked worries of higher interest rates. Investors fear that if stronger than expected growth persists, that the Federal Reserve could attempt to inch rates higher at a faster pace. Fed Chair Janet Yellen noted last week that if the U.S. labor situation improves more quickly than anticipated, rates will be forced higher than expected. Nevertheless, precious metals investors are wise to remember that markets are forward-looking mechanisms, which likely have already discounted the scenario. Elsewhere, seasonal factors are improving for the gold and silver sector, with an increase in purchases expected with India's upcoming festival season, which begins now and runs through fall, which is then followed by the wedding season. Jewelers tend to boost stockpiles in anticipation. In addition, Christmas, Hanukkah, and related holidays are traditionally solid times for the metals. Chinese purchases also pick up near the year end, before the Lunar New Year celebration in February. The nation recently claimed the title of world's biggest gold importer. Precious metals bottom line. Well, although the U.S. dollar rally continues, the metals are showing some solid signs, including palladium and the XAU. Until, though, investors' love affair with equities wanes, I expect this consolidation to likely continue. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the third week running. Wall Street cheered the better-than-expected GDP figures. A solid economy leads to stronger sales and corporate profits, in turn sending share prices higher. For the week, the Dow added 97 points, around 0.5%, finishing above the 17,000 point and less than 2 points from the highest weekly close in history. The S&P 500 was up 15 points, up about 0.75%, finishing at 2003. That's a new all-time record weekly close, while the Nasdaq blasted higher by 41 points, finishing at 4580, nearly 1% for the week, and the best close since the year 2000 implosion. The markets will be closed Monday in observance of the Labor Day holiday in the U.S. Meanwhile, U.S. stocks drifted higher ahead of the three-day Labor Day holiday, bolstered by solid domestic economic reports and expectations of further European central bank stimulus. The U.S. Consumer Sentiment Index for August topped expectations, while the U.S. PMI figure increased to 64 in August. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, personal income climbed 0.2% in January, slightly less than expected, while consumer spending inched lower by 0.1%. Several stocks blasted higher, including my alpha stocks candidate GFI, Goldfields, which gained nearly 25% this week alone. Congratulations, Alpha Stock newsletter subscribers. Plus, news sent Tesla, TSLA, shares higher by about 2.5% to 270 on news that the electric auto manufacturer partnered with China Unicom to build 400 charging stations in 120 cities across China. Brilliant. Is this not the way of the future? We have got to wake up and start following in their footsteps. What a positive event. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, despite record weekly closes across many of the key stock indexes, the 7-component sentiment index remains in the fearful camp. Now, this aberration is viewed as a strong contrarian sign indicating that the herd has not yet directed capital flows into the markets. So I expect the market rally to persist for the foreseeable future. And for next week's stock candidates, all the stock picks and market forecasts, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with must-hear discussions with Louis Navalier and the institutional advisor himself, Bob Hoy. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek.com radio. Louis Navalier runs Navalier and Associates and is also editor of 4 leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Great to be here.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about your latest report. You talk about corporate earnings. Now, clearly, this is a key component to every equities bull market. You know, after all, even Warren Buffett has shown for decades that steady, predictable earnings, a key to success, although it's not as sexy maybe as the high-flying stocks, the reliability of earnings seems to win in the long run. In your latest newsletter, you do outline how this is the best announcement season that you've seen in years. Tell us some more, please.
You know, I just finished doing my emerging growth letter. To say that earnings are strong is a bit of an understatement. My average sales this last quarter were up 70.6%, and earnings were up a whopping 374.4%. Now, that's as good as it's ever going to get. For the third quarter, they're supposed to decelerate. Sales are supposed to decelerate to an annual pace of 52.6, and earnings are supposed to decelerate to about 147.8. Now, I have earnings surprise on average. The analysts will revise their estimates higher, so I'll probably do better than that. But the reason earnings momentum has just peaked here is the dollar's gotten strong. And earnings were being fueled by a weak dollar that was driving commodity prices higher. And companies were reaping windfall profits from their overseas business. So all of a sudden now we're in a deflationary environment where we've got falling food and energy prices, and earnings will decelerate here a bit even though the economy looks fine. But the other good thing that's going on is they can't raise rates. Britain and the U.S. said they're going to raise rates. Now they say, no, not till wages go up. And global yields collapsed in August, when the German 10-year bond crossed below 1%. It's almost been cut in half this year. And now there's this global capital flight, all these trillions of dollars that central banks have pumped in. and sloshing all over the place, and one of the recipients is the U.S. stock market. And that's why we went up in August in light volume. It's a very, very exciting time.
I wonder if you could outline a few companies with solid prospects. I know that you keep a core group without giving anything proprietary away. Maybe a few companies that you like.
Well, let's talk about, I have a little drone company. I have a big one called Northrop Grumman, makes the Global Hawk drone. But my little one is AVAV. That's AeroVironment, Apple Victor. They just reported 35% sales growth. Their earnings were up even in a more impressive 1,000%. And there's not good analyst estimates on this company, but they're a classic example of one I expect a surprise from. Because last I saw, the drone business is pretty good, especially at police departments and things like that. Another good example of a company that's supposed to have just blowout earnings is Ring Energy, REI. Their sales forecast the next quarter is supposed to be up 408%. Earnings supposed to be up 1,550%. Obviously, they got a bunch of new wells on, and I know gas and crude oil prices are soft, but they got all these new wells coming on board, and so they're going to have just stunning sales and earnings growth. So the fracking business is very, very good. Our biggest winner, which we still like, in fact, we bought more of it today, is Vishop Holdings, VIPS. This is a Chinese, basically a Chinese Amazon, but they make money. Amazon in the United States forgets to make money every now and then. And their sales are forecast to be up 125% next quarter, and their earnings supposed to be 183%. So that's just stunning. It's just stunning. So I've got lots of earnings. Earnings are not a problem. The biggest problem we have is that we're starting to enter a deflationary environment, so we're going to have to be very careful of some of our energy-related stocks. But this looks awfully good right now.
Tell us some more about deflationary environment. You talk about the Fed holding rates low for the foreseeable future in the newsletter because they keep rattling that saber with regard to higher rates. But the other side of the pond there, the ECB lowered its rates now, as I know you know, into negative territory. First time that I can remember in history that a major central bank lowered rates below zero.
Our Fed's being somewhat responsible by trying to wind down quantitative easing. It should be wound down by October. Now, because they've done all this money pumping, they've gone from an $800 billion balance sheet in 2008 to a $4.5 trillion balance sheet. And they've taken over $2 trillion of that to shore up the mortgage-backed market. It just doesn't hit on all cylinders now. So they tried to save that market, and they were successful. But they're not going to give all this money back. They're going to keep that $4.5 trillion balance sheet. With interest, we'll get up to $5 trillion. And they're going to continue to manipulate interest rates. The big problem and the big event that caused the market to rally in August was European yields. Even though our GDP resurged to 4% annual pace in the second quarter, that was a preliminary number, it's going to get revised, Europe basically went into recession. You've got Germany, France, and Italy all either flat or contracting. That freaked everybody out. Their yields plummeted. And the European Central Bank is out of control on their money pumping. They basically told their member banks to go ahead and borrow at 1% and go buy the government bonds. So they drove the bond yields for Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain dramatically lower. Spain bond yields, 10-year bond yields, fell below U.S. yields this year. And, in fact, Spain's at the lowest interest rate since 1789. And that's trillions of dollars. The banks in Europe are so busy arbitraging, borrowing from the ECB at 1% and buying something with a higher yield, they forgot how to lend. So they would park their excess reserves with the European Central Bank, and they charge them negative rates. And then basically the ECB saying, hey, go out and lend this money. Well, guess what happens when you're lazy? You don't want to do that. So all of a sudden the U.S. dollar started to rally, so they just started to dump their money over here. So they're getting a currency tailwind, okay? Plus they're buying our yields, and they're going lower, which is a short-term appreciation. And so it's the European money that is actually driving our yields now lower. And, it's a very small world out there. It's pretty amusing. So, our central bank action was coordinated, and it seems to be not coordinated anymore, although they just got together at Jackson Hole in Wyoming, and I think they had a little chat now that they're a little bit more coordinated all of a sudden.
This month is a particularly challenging one for Wall Street. Traders on sabbatical. You also point out that the lull could be a good buying opportunity, though, for conservative A-rated stocks.
We should rally go into Labor Day weekend, like we go into most holiday weekends. If you look, we rallied into Memorial Day weekend. We rallied in July 4th weekend. We're going to rally into Labor Day weekend because people are going to be happy. We will cringe around September 11th because of all the chaos in the world, but that'll be a good buying opportunity then, and hopefully nothing bad will happen. But the drop-dead date for everybody to get in, the last person in the pool, is September 30th. So historically, in a midterm election year, September 30th has been the best buying point, and we rally going into the midterm elections. Obviously, we're going to have more gridlock after the midterms, as you do in most midterms. Wall Street loves gridlock. Apparently, government can't do anything. And so the private sector will just grow and prosper regardless of government. And then we get all the seasonal surge. We're still going to have a very good third quarter earnings announcement season. Not quite as strong as it was in the second quarter. But and then you hit the happy time of year. You know, from Thanksgiving of the year, the markets traditionally rally. There's year-end pension funding. People are happy in the holidays, and that rubs off on the stock market, and you often have a nice small cap rally. I mean, August has been very significant because we've rallied with no volume. And so August was really capital flight from fixed income investors seeking yield. You know, stock market still yields over 2%. That's more than the bank. It's tax advantaged. But it was really not only U.S. capital flight, international capital flight, and then, of course, if we can rally with no volume in the seasonally strongest month, it's a big deal. And corporate buybacks are definitely picking up. CNBC's out there broadcasting buybacks are slowing down. They don't know what happened in August. They're going off of old data. I can tell you, because I have 37 stocks buying back $1 billion or more a year, the buybacks picked up big time in August.
And you show quite an interesting graphic there, which illustrates the significance of buybacks relative to stocks. But I wonder if you could give us more of a specific view of how this fuels value. I mean, obviously, there's fewer shares out there. Supply and demand dictates that we'll have a higher price. Tell us more, please.
Well, sure. One of the more controversial stocks I own is Lockheed Martin. It yields about over 3%. It's retired almost 40% of its float. So what people don't realize is that we may be cutting back, but our allies are buying like crazy. And, of course, there's all that tension in the world, so that's good. And then finally, so that gets their sales up. But Lockheed's a huge IT company. They have been stabilizing their stock with their dividend and relentless stock buybacks. Their dividend payouts are actually lower than they were a few years ago because they bought back over 40% of their stock. But when a CFO buys back his stock, his earnings per share go up. So let's just say earnings are flat, okay, and he buys back 10% of outstanding stock, his earnings per share will go up 10%. So relentless corporate buybacks are boosting their line earnings per share. Now, a lot of people will say, well, this is financial engineering. This is smoke and mirrors. Well, yeah, it is. But every kid that goes to business school learns about finance 101, whether they should borrow in the debt or equity markets. And what happens is if Wall Street doesn't price your stock right, and you have my average large cap stock has a return equity of 28%, and if they can borrow at 3 or 4 and buy their stock back with that high return equity, their earnings per share is going to soar. And so when you have relatively low price earnings ratios, as we do now, you know, our average large cap stocks barely at 15 times forecasted earnings, and you can borrow at such low rates, you're going to keep borrowing, buying your stock back. My average large-cap stock is going to be gone in 18 years. It looks like the buyback pace is picking up, so I might have to revise that to 15 years. So it's whether this is right or wrong, this is what's happening, and this is a big, big deal. And that's why every dip is a buying opportunity, and that's why the market can't have a big correction, because corporate America is waiting for every little dip out there to buy their stock back.
I want all of our listeners to really digest what you've pointed out, because I think this is key. Essentially, you like the fact that we have a low interest rate environment, because this allows big caps in particular with strong return on equities to have a cash buffer between what they're borrowing at and the liquidity and cash that they have on hand. That is cash that has to be put to use, and we don't have a rip-roaring economy, so they're buying back their shares.
Correct. And, you know, corporate America also has two sets of books. They have domestic treasury and international treasury. And so, you know, a lot of people wondered, how did Navalier end up in Reno, Nevada? Well, it's pretty simple. I'm from California, and guess where the California companies and the big Washington companies like Microsoft keep their cash? Reno, okay? Apple, Cisco, Oracle, Intel, the Intuit founders, my neighbor. Microsoft's the biggest employer there, and Amazon's huge there. So they're running their cash through Reno because they don't want to have the corporate taxes on their domestic revenue. Now, what's happening is then they have their international treasury. Now, that's going to be in Ireland or Singapore or someplace else. Now, as these companies build up all this cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and it's fine if they want to expand. They will not repatriate that money because they don't want to pay the tax differential. You know, so if you pay 25%, say, in Canada, and you want to bring it back to the United States, you got to pay another 14%. So what they do is they leave that cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and they often will use that money to buy their stock back and or, okay, use that collateral over there to borrow extra cheap over here, which is exactly what Apple did. You know, Apple got up to $179 billion overseas, so they could just borrow extra cheap because they have all this money sloshing over there. So, you know, there's this big gossip about inversions and all stuff. I can tell you, forget it, the S&P 500 is not chartered in the United States anymore. It's been gone for years, okay? Don't ask me why the financial media is talking about this now. They left a long time ago. You cannot find a big U.S. energy company headquartered in the United States. Halliburton's Qatar, Transocean is Swiss.
But what about Sunoco? I love Sunoco.
Well, you know, I have to check that. You know, MEMC Electronics, Mountain View, California, that's Cayman Islands. Seagate Technology was Ireland for a long time. I mean, just don't be surprised, okay? So, you know, obviously a lot of the pharmaceutical companies are Irish, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, these companies go to the low tax havens, they keep their cash there, that cash has been burned a hole in their pocket, and if they don't know how to invest it, they just buy their stock back. So the buybacks are not, I don't see them ending. I mean, you know, if Wall Street doesn't price a stock properly, corporate America has every right to go back and buy their stock back, and that's exactly what's happening. So this is very, very exciting. This is not being told by the media. You know, Herb Greenberg loves to get up and demonize buybacks.
Also wanted to ask you about the latest Fed's minutes there. I mean, we saw a sea change, you might say, at least in the general sentiment, and we're starting to hear some hawkish talk coming from the Fed. But you aren't buying it. You think this is, they're just trying to talk the markets down. What do you think?
Well, first of all, the hawks are a minority at the Fed. And Charles Posner, I believe, voted against what the Fed statement was last time. He's to say he's hot as a pistol is an understatement. He's PO'd, okay? So the bottom line is you have a lot of progressive people at the Fed trying to fix everything by throwing money at it. And Janet Yellen, our new Fed chairman, is a labor economist. And she came up with her own indicator, 19-component indicator, to explain that even though the unemployment rate fell, the job market isn't fixed and the Fed hasn't fulfilled its unemployment mandate. So she's looking at there's too many temp jobs. You know, a lot of companies are still keeping people under 30 hours a week because they don't want to pay for their health care because the costs are uncertain. Even if the costs were certain, there's a Cadillac tax coming in 2018. I know I'm personally going to get hit with that from my health plan. It's too generous. I mean, I got to strip something out like anesthesia or something. But I think the government makes me have that anyway. So they're going to try to throw me to an exchange. So, because our health plan is just too generous. So what's happened is they're keeping the people under 30 hours a week. The labor force participation is at a 36-year low. And the most ironic thing is the folks over 55 are working more than ever. Now, there's this myth that the labor force participation is 36-year low because the baby boom's turning gray. But then how come everybody over 55 is working more than ever? So in this era where, 80 is the new 60 because you can't retire with low rates, the job market is really, really messed up right now. There's no wage growth, which is really Yellen's big thing. There's too many temp jobs. And the core of the workforce, 25 to 54, is not recovered yet, okay? There was some hope in recent months, but it's just not recovered. So until we get some wage growth and more full-time jobs, they're going to keep pumping, and this could be for years. And I don't mean to be political on you, but, you know, Eric Cantor is the guy that was close to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he got defeated because he wanted this immigration reform. because you had companies like Darden Restaurants and Marriott pushing him big time that we need more foreigners and temporary work visas. And, you know, I happen to live in South Florida, so I see this. You know, you go to hotels, you go to restaurants, you'll get people that are from somewhere else, you know, South Africa or Peru or some other place, and they're there for 6 months and they disappear. And you see the same thing at a ski resort. A foreigner on a temporary work visa is cheaper than hiring an American or legal alien. Because if you hire an American legal alien and you let them go when the season turns down, you've got to give them unemployment. You know, the whole hotel and restaurant business has figured this out, okay, and so is the ski industry. So what's happened is we need more of those foreigners and temporary work visas, at least the big companies are lobbying Congress for, and that's been pushing immigration reform under the surface. Obviously, you know, it didn't get through because Eric Cantor got lost, but this is one of the things that, you know, still might get through.
But what do you say to folks who point to Canada, which has relatively low immigration, but, you know, the younger crowd fills that void for menial or, let's say, manual labor. They pick in the fields. They work in the hotels. They work, you know, behind the scenes, busing tables. The argument that's being made there is this creates a, let's call it an economic backstop for the middle class.
Well, let me be very clear on Canada. I know Canada a little bit too well. My wife's Canadian. In fact, I can still make my kids Canadian before they're 18 if I wanted to, in case there's a draft or something. But the truth of the matter is Canada doubled its population in the last 30 years, and they did double it with very orderly immigration. But the Canadian immigration is a little different. They basically, when you're up there, they say, got any money? 475, I think, now. But it used to be a quarter million. And so basically you can immigrate there if you bring money. Now, you can immigrate to the United States if you bring money, too. Okay, and I personally think the easiest way to solve all our fiscal problems is to let about 100 million new immigrants in with 2 million each. And also, you want all those people that go to our fancy universities to basically give them a work visa if possible. You know, if you go to Microsoft and Redmond, it is India. For some reason, India makes more programmers than other countries. So Redmond is India. Well, they can't get all the programmers in, so they got them up in British Columbia. And, you know, it's going to get to the point where Microsoft's going to be a lot bigger outside the United States than in it, and that's all because of the work visa problem. So it's interesting what's happening in America, but I think we do want to look to Canada. You know, whether we like it or not, Social Security and some of these other things seem to be pyramid schemes, so we need to get more people paying in, and that's... another thing we might want to do.
Well, you know, I will point back to India and just note that for decades there was a huge push for technical skills, particularly with programming, all throughout the country there. If you had one of the higher scores in your community, you could get an almost fully paid spot at the university. So it really drove that programming slash computering skill set for decades. Also wanted to ask you a bit more, though, about this inflation outlook. Rates inflation will be back on the table as, I think, a key component in the markets.
Normally, the money pumping results of inflation, but the velocity of money, how fast money changes hands, is turned down. So near term, what's happened is the dollar rally, last I looked at the euro's at a one-year low and the dollar's at a one-year high. The dollar rally is shoving all commodity prices down. Doesn't matter whether it's precious metals, you know, wheat, corn, soybeans. There are exceptions. Copper prices are up. Beef prices are still high. Hog prices are firm. But the truth of the matter is that the strong dollar caused food and energy prices to decline near term. So, and also, this is the time of year where energy will turn down. Turns down in the fall. We've had an unusually cool summer. It's, global cooling, I guess, is going to cause it to turn down a bit. But in the fall, naturally does that. So it's gone for now, but it will come back. You just can't have all this money sloshing around not cause inflation.
Well, you know, I'd also point to palladium, which, as you know, Russia, the number one producer, there's some concern there could be supply disruption issues due to the Ukraine drama.
And platinum as well, because platinum comes from Russia and South Africa, and South Africa likes to have like a 40-day strike.
Yep, they just wrapped up the latest. Okay, I want to ask you, though, about your geopolitical standpoint. Now, we're seeing a lot of trouble in the Ukraine standoff. We also have Gaza, and then we have Iraq, a trifecta, if you will. Tell us more.
I should be very, very careful. I bought a whole bunch of defense stocks early this year. Didn't they know that this is the most peaceful time in history? And Okay, well, what's happening is they're selling to our allies because of all the tension in the world. Now that tension is broken out. We're very proud that we own Raytheon, which is the Iron Dome of protecting Israel. And, you know, what Israel does is if a missile's coming in and it's going to land in the field, they won't shoot it down. But if it's going to go to an urban area, they'll shoot it down. It's 20 grand to shoot down each one. So we've been, Raytheon's done very, very well. The spy business is great. So the drone business, Northrop Grumman, AVAV, that small drone company, it's just phenomenal. Finally, IT business is good. Spying is good, as Lockheed Martin is. I've got a HII, which does all the Navy ships, had very good earnings. Astronics, another new one I'm adding. They're selling a lot to the Defense Department. There may be a void in the world. We may not be protecting as many people as we used to, but the arms business is very good. In fact, I actually bicycle with a guy who was sanctioned by the UN and is an arms dealer. He's happy. This is the greatest environment it's ever been for him, and he just thinks Putin's a great guy. I mean, because it's good for his business. So it's what's happened in the Ukraine is very tragic. It's obviously Russia wants their oil pipelines or their natural gas pipelines to be flowing freely. There was an alternative pipeline they were trying to build around Ukraine that they're not too crazy about. You know, they know Europe's not going to do a lot, but Russia did hurt their currency when they did this. They joined the emerging market crisis, and what's going on is not very acute. Now, as far as Gaza's concerned, I mean, obviously, you've got to take out Hamas, and because they're launching missiles, and the head of Hamas is worth $2.6 billion. Arafat, used to live in Switzerland. So it's unfortunate that they've had these leaders that are, less than ideal, but they've signed their death warrant. And then we'll see what happens with ISIS now. I mean, obviously we're trying to protect the Kurds, and we got the dam back, and we'll have to see how all this unfolds. The world's a bit of a mess. And as sirens go off, you got 15 seconds for all the shrapnel comes down. I go to Israel a lot. It's a long story why I go there, but you got to get underground. You got to get somewhere safe because even when you shoot it down, the shrapnel's coming.
Any positive comments? My guess is that you'll be looking for some type of capitulation in the next 6 to 12 months in the precious metals that might lead to a bargain buying opportunity.
Well, gold never did retest its low. It might have to do that. But the chaos in the world is good for the precious metals. I just think they're reacting negatively to the dollar right now. I think as the chaos builds, it might firm up a bit. The Indian wedding season is over. You've had some central bank selling that hurt the gold market. We took the sanctions off of Iran. Iran was in oil for gold deals. Now they do oil for dollar deals. So, it's interesting. Gold's just in a trading range, and I think people have to realize that. But if the market's going to go down for about 14 days, I guarantee you gold will be the best performer. And as you mentioned, the platinum, the palladium plays, those are industrial metals that everybody needs, and the supply sources are very suspect right now. So those are not bad places to and the other precious metals to look at. Silver is just much more volatile. I wish I could give people good advice on silver. My main advice is just take gold and make it three times more volatile.
Well, I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services that you provide at Navalier Advisor.
We're a money management firm. We manage a few billion dollars. We don't count our bond business, which is over a billion a year, but basically we're a money management firm. We have a free stock grader out there that people want to take advantage of. Our dividend grader launches in early September. You have to grade stocks differently for dividends than you do for stocks. So at NavalierGrowth.com, you can go there and see how your stocks rank. If you'd like us to do the portfolio checkup for you, we're honored to do that. We give free portfolio checkups. But we are an institutional manager. We have big institutional accounts, billion-dollar accounts. We charge pretty low fees if we do manage money, but the other thing that's odd about us is we're one of the few managers who work for incentive fee. We like to charge 10% of profits once a year. The SEC restricts on who's available for that, but that's become very popular on fixed income or dividend type accounts nowadays. Fees are a very sensitive issue on yield, so we prefer to just charge 10% of profits once a year, and we wait a whole year to bill. And then I'm a huge investor myself. I have a new fund out there. I started. It's my third fund. It's growing rapidly. I have money in all my funds, so we have a lot of fun out there.
Louis Navalier, we want to thank you for your time and also a hat tip for being one of the sharpest advisors with a really solid track record. Very difficult industry to have that moniker, and we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Great. An honor.
Well, my featured guest today has been advising institutional clients for over three decades. Bob Hoy is editor-in-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Mr. Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you and good to be with your listeners.
So much on the geopolitical front. Why don't you tell us, you know, what you're making of this Ukraine-Russia drama?
Well, actually, I hadn't seen the term used before, but a week ago I coined the phrase Putin and his neo-Soviet. And he's an ex-KGB. He likes authority. He's very good at selling his package to the Russians. And to have Ukraine, last December, Kiev, the main city, in a riot, well, it was a protest riot for freedom. And they had a bunch of Moscow cronies in there running the government, and they were a bunch of kleptocrats and ripping the money off. So then the Russians then were putting in bandits, because when those protests were on in Maidan Square, there were snipers up on the roof killing people. Mm. And trained snipers. They take a lot of work. So anyways. Now, in talking to my buddies yesterday, I said, you know, what is the seasonality to war? Well, traditionally it was once the fall harvests were completed and the crops were in, then you could go to war. So then this business of sending down a convoy of white-painted trucks with supposed humanitarian stuff in it was just a decoy. They're nasty. And the problem is that at the moment, this is a European problem. And Europeans at the moment don't have the leadership to say, let's stop this sort of stuff. And certainly the American leadership is the reverse. It's in a historical sense, war or warlike gestures really don't change the course of a financial market. It runs on its own track. It was like, for example, in the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. I mean, that was real nasty. And at one point, Paris was besieged for about a year. People were actually almost starving because the food wasn't getting in. And yet the bubble, financial bubble that is, with stocks and commodities and real estate outside of that, hey, went right up and concluded a bubble in 1873, and then you went into a long contraction. So to wrap up the strife in Ukraine and in the Middle East, it really doesn't change the major movements in the financial market. So we'll just move on past that and then look at what else is going on here in the financial markets. Well, on the stock market, we had, five, 6 weeks ago, the momentum and sentiment figures were up there, and you also, to levels of confidence that you only see at a cyclical peak in the stock market. Now, sometimes in some of these peaks, the bullish sentiment figure may not be with the exact high in the market because, you know, you got different sectors of the market peak at different times, but we mainly focus on the S&P. So then you had this, which is, you can't call that sucker back because the speculation has been outstanding. And so We then recently here, 1st of August, the stock market became oversold. It was into what we call a springboard buy, and then it moved up pretty quickly. Now it's an inverted springboard. But basically, on the longer term, on the S&P, we now have what we call an upside exhaustion signal. And this is a function of momentum and time and a number of things. And we haven't had one in decades. This didn't even generate one in 2007. It did in 2000, which was a very high momentum peak. So short-term indicators are working, and the long-term indicator, the upside exhaustion, has come in on the stock market. This is very significant stuff. Also, by the way, Chris, on the model that gives the upside exhaustions, it's also designed to determine bottoms, and we call that a downside capitulation. And this gave, the bottom after the 2000 crash and one was September, October 2002, gave a capitulation by then, and then in late 2008, and then again in March 2009. So the model does work on the big moves at either end. So we'll watch now for a failure in the S&P, and that would mean the rest of the market. So now the other big item out there that doesn't get the media coverage to the degree has been, it's been a huge bubble in lower grade bonds, junk bonds, high yield, all that sort of stuff. And it's been immense. Just so let's look back on bubbles here. Just in our own experiences, the 1970s was huge run up in producer price index, and CRB, the commodity index, and wages, they were inflating, and of course the CPI rolled right out up to, I think it was about 14 or 15%. But that was sort of a bubble in consumer goods and wages. Then another while you go along, and then you get to the 1999-2000 mania, which was strictly in high-tech stocks, so dot-com bubble, all that sort of stuff. But it didn't include big action in commodities, and it didn't include a bull market in real estate, a dynamic bull market in real estate. So then by the time you then get to 2007, you had everything in place. You had good prices for commodities, and you had part of that one, an outstanding mania in residential house prices. And if you look back in the 1920s, you had the residential real estate mania focused on Florida, but it was elsewhere. And then that was part of the mania, and we had it this time. So 2007 goes down in the books like 1929. And so that was that bubble. And but now you have, yes, you've had a fabulous bull market in stocks, but beyond that you've got this bubble in low-grade bonds, and everybody's been issuing stuff, countries that, and companies that should not be issuing because it became a mania on the buyer's side. And at some point, the economy, which has been recovering, it's not been a robust recovery, but no country or company will be able to service the amount of debt that's been strapped on. So at some point, we can get what happened in the 1930s, which was a great bond revulsion where people said, I can't own this and I can't service it, and so debt was written off. But it became so bad that even long-dated treasuries were marked up in yield as well. So I think this is going to be the most exciting event over the next 2 years. It might take that long. So now we look at the technical side, our junk bond, on junk bonds. Anybody wants to follow it, the symbol's JNK. But it went up and gave a very high momentum reading, but you can't find the sentiment figures on that are not so good as you get in the stock market, but you got a very high momentum reading. And
then a good correction recently, then it's recovered and it's testing the high. And so the other thing is that seasonality is that often you can have a strong bond market in lower grade bonds going into May, and then you can get a seasonal whack to it, which we did get, and then you have a weaker recovery on low grade bond prices, which we have been getting. But this is now the fifth year since coming out of the crash of 2009, and that's about as long, 5 years is a pretty good long time to have a party. So we think that then the seasonal tendency for credit spreads to widen in the fall could be a problem. And particularly in that we're out at 5 years and everything is mature, everybody's fully committed. And I'd like to add that the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve policy of buying huge amounts of bonds has been extremely reckless. But it's been allowed to happen because there have been players in low-grade bonds. You'll notice that it's not particularly happening in commodities, and it's not happening in gold and silver. So we should sort of review those as well. And you had effectively in 2011 a decade-long bull market in gold and silver stocks blow out. In retrospect, there was a lot of bad business being done. Even the big senior companies were trying to develop mines in geographically impossible places or even politically impossible places, so there's been a long write-up. But on the technical research on that one, we follow the silver-gold ratio because in a bull market for both metals, typically silver will outperform gold, so which that was happening. And we use a momentum measure called the RSI. And in April, May of 2011, that RSI got up to 92. So we look back and historically, and the only time it had ever been that high before was in January 1980, which was the top of that bubble in precious metals. So we pointed out it was dangerous, and we felt that it wouldn't be the disaster that followed 1980, but it would be a bear market. Then you had the second run-up, which peaked in September of 2012, and on that one, the RSI got up to, I think it was 80, which is high. Anything above 78 on that is sort of a danger warning. And then you had the next leg down. So what is being accomplished in the precious metal sector is the cleaning up of a decade of recklessness. So, and this isn't going to be done overnight. So you have here. Now, here's where you're setting up for something really interesting in gold, is because in a boom in stocks and bonds, typically the real price of gold goes down, and traditionally one would measure the real price of gold by taking the price in U.S. dollars and deflating it by the consumer price index. But the calculation, as we all know, of the CPI in the U.S. is suspect, and then also it only comes out once a month. So what we did is decided to say that the real price of gold can be determined by its price relative to commodities. So the trick then was to find a commodity index that didn't have gold in it, because you don't want to have gold on the top side of the divisor and on the bottom side of the divisor. The Economist All Items Commodity Index has been the longest one, and it does not have gold in it, but we couldn't get the raw data on that, so we created our own commodity index, which we hoped would be somewhat similar to the Economist. And the behavior is sort of similar, so it's our proxy for gold's real price. So where this is useful, like in 2007, because you were having a bull market in stocks and bonds, the real price of gold was heading down, and it bottomed in May of 2007, and when it turned up, in effectively gave the sell signal on all the party items, stocks and bonds and whatnot. So then it went up. It soared from, I think, I call it was like 150. And on index, it saw, it went all the way up to around 500 in February of 2009 as everything else was crashing. And then that gold divided by commodity index turned down, which then gave the buy on everything else. So throughout history where you've got prices of things, gold, which is money, acts opposite to whatever the action is. So we now, this gold by divided by commodity index bottomed in June, early June, and then it started to recover, and then it had a correction in July. So now we say that it's turned trend, and sometime later the speculation in stocks and bonds should fail, and as we said earlier, it's getting close to that now. But the this index now needs to break above 390, and it's sort of around 370. So the next move down for commodities, and if gold maintains it steady or somewhat up, it should break out, and then that's another warning. But where this becomes important, Chris, is that say you're running a mining company and the price of gold is fixed at $20.67, which it was in the 1920s and 1930s. And during the 1920s boom, you had wage rates going up for miners because the base metals were booming. You had cost of energy going up. Price of crude oil was going up relative to gold. So if you were then running, say, Homestake, which was the premier producer at the time, your costs were going up, but your price was fixed. So your earnings went down, which it did in 1929. And it went down, and I think they reported a loss that year. And then with the crash, which took commodity prices down and base metals fell, and base metal mining companies were faltering and mines were being shut down, so then you had a surplus of miners. And with the real price of gold going up, profitability started to flow into the gold mining side. So you take a look at Homestake, which, if I recall rightly, reported a loss in 1929, and their stock went down to 8.8 or something like that. But you could have bought it through all 1930 for, say, $9 a share. And then by 1935, it was up to $62 a share. And in those days, the gold mining companies paid everything out they made in dividends. By all their earnings, they paid out in dividends. So you're getting $4.50 a share on a $9 purchase. But the point being is that you assume that their mill rates were the same, grades were the same, and running the same. But because their costs fell, their earnings went up. And so we get by the end of 1932, where Roosevelt had not yet started the experiment in depreciation, their earnings were up something like 130%, and the stock was up 130%, which is outstanding. And then after that, 1933 is when Roosevelt started fooling around. So then what he did is he raised the price of gold, but in every post-bubble deflation, the real price of gold goes up. So the government then was reinforcing what goes on anyway, so that's where it became such a big party. But if you look at all of the post-bubble depression periods in the past, it has been very favorable to gold mining, and we were able to get copper prices back to 1820 or something like that. And if you deflate those by a reliable CPI, too, you end up that copper prices go down during the long post-bubble deflations, and the gold price goes up. Now, then there's a lot of us interested in silver. And unfortunately, silver doesn't do as good as gold in a post-bubble deflation. That's just the way it is. There's nothing we can do about it. And all the guys out there that are calculating that every year you got a shortage of gold because the consumption is greater than production, those numbers don't count. What really matters is what's going on in the financial market. So what we're looking for here now is that as you go into uncertainty in these markets, and this should become more visible as we get through into September, that the really careful money will go to the most liquid items. I mean, it's not interested in making money or return. It's just interested in protecting money. So the most liquid items are still U.S. T-bills. It's always been T-bills in the senior currency. And then the other one is the unique liquidity that gold provides. So the investment demand will increase for gold, and then that, as the investment demand for base metals disappears, or for crude oil, you can see the real price going up, and then profitability increasing in the industry. And then you got the problem, okay, when do you buy the stocks? So if we're looking at liquidity problems becoming visible maybe by the middle of September and maybe stock prices heading down, well, no matter what is going on in gold, well, gold shares are not going to go up. So we think that the time to buy gold would be now, and the time to buy gold shares would be on opportunity later in the year if the financial storm comes in.
What I'd like to do is address this concept you have here, a big paradigm shift away from particularly junk bonds, as well as the stocks and equities. You know, I'm starting to see deterioration in equities as well as you run through, you know, the hundreds of stocks you're on your watch list. And you notice that the higher highs are becoming harder to find, although the indexes keep hitting records. Tell me, if you would, maybe just what would happen if suddenly there was large capital flows away from equity and bond benchmarks. Would that be a sea change event that could shift the tide back into commodities and maybe even precious metal?
And when the bid goes out of the low-grade bonds, it's going to be like people are going to be sucking wind like you can't believe, because all of a sudden, you know, liquidity has disappeared. As to money going out, you know, when you get a sudden reversal after a bubble condition, there are no bids. So the money doesn't go out. Everything just gets marked down in price. Yeah, quick and nimble traders can get out. Others can get short. But for the whole broad swath of institutions, they just get stuck because you can't move. Now, and you did ask about commodities. At the moment, we've got a buy on crude oil and natural gas. And what's the other one? Cotton, I think, is looking good. Oh, yeah. The grains got so beat up, and wheat came down to this week and gave what we call a sequential buy on wheat. So, yes, some commodities can rally, but this would be just a technical opportunity. It wouldn't be a paradigm change to a major bull market for commodities, because we are in a post-bubble contraction. The bubble top was set in 2007. The crash ended 2009. And this is the first business expansion out of the crash. So what we're looking at is the equivalent of 1937. If your parents were around during the Depression, you'll remember them saying that after 1938, it was the Depression within the Depression. That's where we are. That there was an economic recovery was in, you know, I mean, just as there was in the after 1932. But this one was expected to be weak, and it has been. But that doesn't mean that the stock market would be weak. It's been incredible. And the move on the S&P in giving us our upside exhaustion figure on a monthly reading, I don't recall when there was none. We checked it the other day, but it goes way back to coming out of a bear market, when you might get an exhaustion reading on, say, the first move. But this one is an exhaustion reading at the end of a five-year bull market. So then, bear market for stocks, bear market for lower-grade bonds, and if you're in a business contraction, there ain't going to be any action in basic industrial commodities. And as I said, what we're looking at here in natural gas and crude and cotton and wheat is just a trading opportunity.
So then you don't see a revival then of the commodities bull market? This is more of a cyclical play?
Yeah, there is a feeling amongst many of the students in the market that because the Fed has been so reckless, that the inflation in commodities will come at some time in the future. You want to back up and look at that in a different way. The Federal Reserve has to have a speculative item out there in order to be able to inject its portion of credit expansion. Financial markets can create any amount of credit on its own. It doesn't need the Fed. All you need is a rising asset, and the players will get leveraged. So it was the bull market in stocks and low-grade bonds that permitted the Fed to be reckless. And when that bull market for that goes away, then the Fed is still pushing on a string story from the 1930s. So the Fed may want to be inflated. By saying that commodities aren't going to go anywhere, it doesn't mean that the Fed has suddenly got discipline. It's that the market, on a recession, there'll be no demand for commodities. Let's take a look at base metals. In the rally up to 2008 and 2011, and I did all the work at the time, and you had the copper, lead, zinc, nickel, aluminum, and you've got the real price. You can deflate it by the PPI. So that increase in, let's just stay for copper, it makes it simpler, was the biggest percent increase in 100 years of data in the real price. Then it stayed up there for a longer time than anything else in 100 years. Now, this had something to do with China. But what you have a high real price for copper, you get a huge expansion of capacity. And then if you're going into another contraction and you've got a huge capacity in base metal mining, you know what's going to happen. So there's no magic wand that says that the Fed, well, now its inflation is going to come out in base metals or precious metals. It just ain't going to happen. And the reason why gold becomes so attractive in a post-bubble deflation is because everything's falling relative to gold. And you then, profitability. Now, in industry, there may be something new. There may be a company or somebody does something different that the market will bid up. But the one thing that you can, that is analyzable, is that in every post-bubble deflation, the price of gold has done very well. And the miners have done very well on it. And discoveries are made. And here's an ironical one for you, Chris. If you take a look at the major gold rushes in history, California, 1849, Klondike, 1895, these were at the bottom of post-bubble contractions. They were at the bottom of the Depression. What do you get at that time? You have high unemployment. You got men looking for work. Then suddenly somebody comes up with a gold discovery. Well, they all rush to it. And that goes all the way back to Depression in 1688. And Prieto, whatever it was, there was a discovery in Brazil that caused a panic and a gold rush and all that sort of stuff. So even the romantic and dramatic side of this story in mining, a gold rush, the biggest ones have occurred at Depression bottoms. Now, on the count of depressions, the 1929 bubble, the depression started, and using the low for interest rates, you'd expect the low end of the depression about mid-1940s, 1946, 47. Now, along came the war, and it was they call it a trough war, World War II. Well, that took a lot of players out of the market, so while you had a good high for the gold's real price then, there was no gold rush because everybody was employed in the war. But other than that, four or five of the major gold rushes occurred at a depression bottom. So, and what are we going to, when are we looking for that one? 20 years after 2007, you might have the end of the depression.
Some exciting times ahead for gold aficionados.
There you are. And here's the other thing is, ages ago, early 70s, I went to a brokerage firm where they were having a presentation with a promoter, a Canadian promoter, or some fabulous deal. I don't remember what the deal was, but I remember the warm-up guy for the promoter was a much older man then. You know, let's go back to 1972, and he had been in the business in the brokerage business in Montreal when it was a highly speculative exchange. And I said to Ma, I said, I knew that the senior gold stocks like Homestake did very well in the Depression, but I didn't at that point have any evidence on how the juniors went. And I asked him, how did they went? And he said, I was in the mining market in the 1930s in Montreal. And he said, one of my biggest clients in 1933 gave me a brand new Ford Roadster as a gratuity. Were they making money in the juniors? Of course. And over fifth.
Well, Bob, we appreciate your comments, and I wish you'd tell folks a bit more about the services you provide, please.
Well, we cover the markets, and although it's called institutional advisors, we do sell research on a retail basis, and you can just check out the website, institutionaladvisors.com, or the Internet being what it is today, just look up Bob Hoy, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, and all the stuff comes up. And we'll put you on the mail-out list for 5 or 6 weeks. If you like it, you take a subscription. If you don't, you walk.
Bob Hoy, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Very good, and thanks again.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. It's a sad commentary on the state of politics and the world in general. When you come across a political cartoon that depicts a tall, masked man in a desert with the head of a golf club standing upright out of the sand, and the caption reads, "This beheading should get Obama's attention." It implies a sense of not being taken seriously. It implies that the event this political cartoon refers to somehow wasn't enough to get the president's attention, or for that matter, the world's attention. And it implies that the next strike will be against something that people value personally, like a golf game, but value nevertheless. It implies that all of us should be on high alert status, and so we should. There's so much happening politically and in the economy that requires high alert status. But I'm afraid too many people have been too tired and too stressed for too long, that those defense mechanisms have become dull, and those survival skills have softened to the point where mistakes from the not too distant past are being repeated and not recognized for the mistakes they are once again becoming. NBC recently reported the rate of repossessions on auto loans jumped 70.2% in the second quarter, with much of that increase coming from finance companies that are not run by automakers, banks, or credit unions. In other words, the repossessions are coming from subprime auto lenders. Those loans are beginning to go bad. The overall auto default rate is still only 0.62% of all auto loans. But how long will that last? Until it can't. Another area of high alert status is interest rates. An interest rate increase would have a detrimental impact on the automotive industry, let alone the housing industry. Last week at the big Fed meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Janet Yellen once again offered no clarity on the timing of the long-awaited, much-anticipated, and highly touted first interest rate increase, which most mainstream economists predict will occur by mid-2015. With all the talk, and that's all there's been is talk, about a recovering or improving economy, the Fed has led everyone to believe that they will raise interest rates so that the improving economy doesn't overheat. How many times have we heard that? Well, we heard nothing from Janet Yellen about when she will start raising interest rates. Instead, she offered more ambiguous uncertainty. Want to know why? She can't raise rates because even a tiny increase in interest rates on the massive debt monster that has been accumulated and keeps growing will suck whatever life remains out of the engine of economic activity that still fuels our economy. How many years has it been now that the Fed has been going to raise interest rates and curtail quantitative easing? How many Fed meetings has it been when they have been going to dig into their toolbox and find new tools to help the economy? The media doesn't have to work all that hard to fool most people anymore, because most people do a pretty good job of fooling themselves. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.